you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Heart Consulting. My pronouns are he, him, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the tools and resources they need to create inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to bring change about effectively. In today's episode, we will discuss religious inclusion and diversity at work and school with Rahime Ramazani. She's a multi-ethnic, neurodiverse American woman who proudly wears her Muslim faith on her sleeve. A visible minority, Rahime knows all too well what it's like to be marginalized and othered in a society that often values white privilege and conformity over diversity and individuality. Rahime is the founder of her own DEI consulting business, Rahime Ramazani Consulting, which was created with the aim of addressing the experiences of marginalized religious, racial, ethnic, and neurodiverse communities in the United States. Her ultimate goal is to create change on individual, interpersonal, and systemic levels that center on dignity, compassion, and justice for all. Welcome, Rahime, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Julian. It is my pleasure to be here.
So this is our third episode that I've had the privilege to host of Inclusion Catalyst. And as we get started today, I was hoping that you might share some of the aspects of your identity that are most important to you.
Absolutely. Thank you. So for sure, Muslim is at the top of that list because I am visibly identifiable in public as Muslim because I wear a headscarf called hijab. Not all Muslim women wear hijab, but I do. And so that makes me stand out in a crowd. People can see me from afar and hopefully they have like curiosity, sincere, respectful curiosity, but some people don't. So it just makes me very aware that people will look at me if I'm having a bad day, if I'm not smiling, if I look grumpy, like they might think of all Muslims and all Islam of like, oh, she's so scary because she's frowning. Like I literally just had like a bad day. Like I'm a human being. I had a bad day. So Muslim is definitely on the top of that list. I would say, and just like other identities from other folks as well, it really depends on where you are. Sure. And kind of like what identities most stand up for you. Like if I'm hanging out with a bunch of Gen Z, I very much feel my millennialness. I very much strongly identify as a millennial. If I'm with a bunch of boomers, if I'm like with my parents and their friends, like I very much feel my millennialness and so on. I would say racial identity is very big as well, because that is also very obvious. I am very pale skinned or like lacking melanin. I actively choose not to use the word fair skin because that like implies a positive connotation, which I would never want to imply. But yeah, I could go on about identity for a long time, but yeah, I would definitely say like millennial, so generation, race, and religion for sure.
Cool. Well, thank you for sharing that. I really, it feels like a critical thing to start off with. So I appreciate you sharing that. So as we get started today, it's actually, we're recording this on July 27th, and just a month ago, there was a pretty significant Supreme Court decision involving religious freedoms in the United States. That was the Kennedy versus the Bremerton School District decision. And I'm just curious, you know, as we kind of developed these questions, it felt like a little bit of the elephant in the room, and I wanted to ask you, you know, maybe to kind of discuss what you've seen as the impact and the response of the American Muslim community to that, if you might share some of that with our.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And this is a really important conversation that I'm glad to see that overall has brought an awareness of white Christian supremacy in the United States, and the idea that the United States says and has always said, like, separation of church and state. But we know. That has never been the case, right? Yeah. And so honestly, for me, it's like the hypocrisy. Like if you don't want to be a secular state, just like say that, and then we can just be honest about it. Or if you want to have a separation of church and state, then let's actually live by that. So the idea being, of course, that we don't want to ever imply that Christianity, the religion, is bad or negative or, you know, wrong as a whole. the idea being just like, you know, other aspects of identity, you know, you could talk about race, ethnicity, nationality, you know, gender, so on and so on. It's not that anyone is bad or wrong and should like be ashamed of their existence, but just that the superiority aspect of things. If one group has all the power and is able to actively or passively oppress other groups, and other groups do not have inclusive access, equitable access to opportunities and feel belonging wherever they are, we're going to be taught, like this Supreme Court ruling specifically has to do with schools. I saw an article from CARE, I believe Chicago, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations, the civil rights organization that addresses Muslim American issues, talking about how already there are so many Muslims in the United States that aren't able to pray, their names aren't properly pronounced, they're like, if they fast during Ramadan, if they're over the age of maturity, so like high schoolers and older, aren't able to fast or take days off for religious holidays, and on and on and on, like, you know, basics of religious inclusion. But again, in this case, like Christian as like the privileged group, again, not the religion of Christianity being like inherently evil, no, that's not what we're saying, but like the superiority aspect of things being that Christian and Christianity is preferred and made space for above and beyond any other religion. And, you know, I'm Muslim, so I'm talking from a Muslim perspective, but this would apply to Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, non-religious groups, like, and so on, right? So it's, right. I'm just using Muslims as my own personal example. So just the idea, like all of them need to be included, again, including non-religious groups as well, like not forcing them to participate in something that they don't believe in. That is very much a problem. So within Muslim communities, it is very concerning, especially if you have, I personally do not have children, but for those in our community who are parents, looking at if you have your child in a public or private non-Muslim school, of course, there are like private Muslim schools, but some parents choose to put their children in non-Muslim schools. What are they going to be exposed to that isn't part of Islamic or Muslim belief systems? You know, that you're not going to know until after the fact. Are they allowed to be Muslim in any way? Are they going to be pressured to participate in prayers that they don't agree with, or, you know, procedures that they don't agree with, and so on?
Yeah. When we were looking forward to having you and thinking about some of these questions and things we wanted to talk about, we kind of ironically thought that maybe we could start by saying that, you know, the Kennedy decision had been about, you know, a man, a Muslim man who had, you know, unrolled his prayer rug, you know, at the center of the football field and, you know, started doing one of his daily five prayers towards Mecca. And it just, you know, and we, like, when you think about the contrast between like those two images, I think it really put into, you know, to your point, like the problem being the superiority or create like the creation of like a hierarchy where you're rank ordering and say, well, access for this particular group is going to be, you know, is going to look like this. Access for this group that has been historically marginalized already is going to be less. And it just ends up kind of reinforcing some of the, you know, some of these existent issues. Yeah. The second thing, because of your, you know, you work in the D&I space, you're a D&I consultant helping organizations, you know, be more inclusive and creating opportunities for and access for all. Could you share a bit about, you know, what's notable about the history and evolution of discriminatory experiences of Muslim Americans in the workplace?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So I would definitely say me living and working in 2022 and this era, I have so much privilege and ability to practice my faith, even though it is still not exactly how we would love it to be. There's so much that I benefit from the work and the struggle that my parents' generation and the generations before experienced, and I stand on their shoulders. And in that way, like the fact that I'm able to wear hijab or the religious head covering, the fact that I'm able to use my actual name. I have like a Persian Arabic hybrid name. Not all Muslims have non-anglicized names. There are many Muslims who have anglicized names. However, there are many who don't have anglicized names, and then they adopt those names for the workplace, like other cultures will do as well, right? Not just Muslims, just so that they can get hired in the first place, so they can keep their job. I have family members who have shared, even to this day in 2022, are actively experiencing discrimination anytime their actual name comes up on an email, and they have asked and required HR to not share their actual name because it is so starkly different. Again, in 2022, this isn't like decades ago, though of course it did absolutely happen decades ago, that they have a completely opposite experience if their non-anglicized name is being used, and if they're like, they choose like an anglicized name of some sort, they are being treated completely differently. You know, if someone is an immigrant and they speak with an accent, there's that. There's, you know, assumptions around, you know, are you a terrorist? What are you doing? Why are you so secretive? Like, no, sir. Like, yeah.
Still.
You know, yeah. If you travel for work, then the whole aspect of traveling and airport security comes up and being randomly selected every single time for travel. I know the last number of times I've traveled, which I haven't flown since COVID, so it's been a long time, but just like how long it's been happening, the airport TSA will take this like swab and swab every single one of my fingers. And I'm like, what are you searching for? And it's like out in public, everyone is watching me. I'm pretending not to be humiliated by the, like, on and on and on. Like, and there's a lot of people who travel for work. This is just a part of their experience. You know, microaggressions such as like, oh, your English is so good. Where did you learn English? Where are you from? No, where are you from? Like on and on. And yeah, there's just so much there. And this is just in the workplace. If you then potentially go to HR or go to your manager and report it, you have gaslighting of like, oh, that's not a big deal. Or, oh, I don't think they meant it that way. Or, oh, you're imagining things, and on and on and on. What kind of inclusive environment is that if I can't even go to the folks who are supposed to be creating and maintaining a safe and inclusive environment, and they are just completely undermining me and ignoring me?
Right. Yeah. It's, I mean, we hear so many of things like the experience around microaggressions, the experience of, you know, being questioned on actual origins or ethnicity. Like, you just hear from people that look all kinds of different ways, except people who look like white Americans. You
know? Yeah. Oh my gosh. And one more thing for sure. I want to make sure. Sorry. I just remembered. I really want to make sure I get this in there, is the idea that it, and I get this honestly a lot. Again, in 2022, and I work in DEI, so I'm surrounded by folks like in other DEI spaces and stuff like that. I can't even imagine people who don't work in like environments that are talking about inclusion and that sort of level, high level things, is the idea that as a Muslim, like, I'm very clear, like, I was born, raised in the United States. The United States is my country of origin. This is where I care and am invested in, like, the political system and what's going on socially and, you know, social justice and all of that. I am active in those spaces and learning and participating in all of that. So if you come to me, whether like online or in person and stuff like that, and like, well, this Islamic country over there in the world does this, well, so you can't complain. I'm like, okay, social justice warrior, sit down. I am not a citizen of that country. I've never been to that country. I don't speak that language. I don't know like anything about the ethnic culture. Again, going into the idea that ethnic culture and nationality is separate than religion, and people do things for many different reasons, not just their religious identity. So like, again, the idea being like, oh, again, this Muslim country does this thing that I don't like and I disagree with, and I might also disagree with it too, but again, like, I am not a citizen of that country. I've never been to that country. Why are you telling me those things? And the idea that, oh, every member of this religious group has to be perfect human beings according to this person's critique, right? Which of course everyone has a different opinion. You all as a giant group, and there are 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, 1.8 billion Muslims. All of you have to be perfect human beings before even one of you gets human rights. Because it's true. Right. And the same thing I've seen. Yeah. Just other, this applies to other groups as well. Like if your critique, if, you know, God forbid, like hopefully no one listening to this podcast is one of those people. But if you see this in the comment section of like folks, I do a lot of content creation, you know, educational content creation. If you see posts from other folks talking about their marginalized identity to educate people and, you know, invite allies in, and you see someone like trolling them, you can like hopefully be an ally in that moment and speak up for them and defend, you know, the marginalized person with the marginalized identity, and just be like, hey, like you can't like critique one individual on one side of the planet, or even like other Muslims. I'm again in the United States, I'm not responsible for all the actions of every Muslim in the United States either. Like I probably don't agree with, I mean, if we share, if you and the person, me and the other person critiquing me, actually have the same like values and moral judgments, we might actually agree that we don't like this thing. But you are just looking at like, oh, you're Muslim and this person that I don't like is Muslim, so therefore, like, I'm going to critique you. Right. No, this other person.
Well, it's so deeply othering, and happens all the time. And to your point, there's it's likely that you and I have way more in common than you would have with, you know, potentially just about anybody that might live in a foreign Muslim country, besides maybe religion, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is. It's a problem. And I mean, so we're all an organization. We're talking about organizations and some of the things that you talked a little bit about allyship. And so, you know, is how do you see the role for the organization or individual leaders in creating more inclusive environments, especially as far as religious discrimination is concerned? That's distinct just from like a general awareness of it.
Yeah. I would definitely say like starting with, and this is not, I don't say this is like, oh, it's so easy. No, it's not easy. But really starting with just incorporating religion into the company's diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Mm-hmm. And again, like the idea being that this benefits everyone, both folks of different religious traditional backgrounds and folks of non-religious backgrounds. Religion is a huge part of many different people's identities if they are a member of a certain faith. It is probably a big part of who they are, and being able to bring that into the workplace authentically, if they choose to, right? The idea with authenticity is we're not going to force people to be like, be authentic, like show me everything about you. Like, no. Like, so it's not like, no, there's like other, anyway, like there's a whole thing, like side note. I have ADHD, so I get like tangents, but it's really like, you'll laugh because it's so hilarious. Someone on LinkedIn shared that they saw a job description that in the job description said there's like mandatory fun. What? Mandatory fun. Like, that's so bizarre. So they're just the same thing, like mandatory authenticity is not authenticity, right?
Right.
So the idea being like folks can bring their faith and religion if they so choose to the workplace as a part of their authentic identity. And this, again, applies to everyone, including Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, on and on and on and on. Everyone.
It's a long list.
Exactly. Like, there's more religions that I could possibly ever name and that I am aware of, and we want to include everyone. Awesome. So that's like the first step. It's very complicated. It's very hard. And just recognizing why is it hard, right? Because there are a lot of very valid reasons for why there's a lot of resistance to that. And instead of being like, no, that's stupid, you need to just suck it up and get over it. No, that's not compassionate. That's not going to be effective in any way. You need to hold space for why is it so like risk averse for folks to talk about religion? Why do people just like, yeah, let's just not talk about it at all because it's so sticky? You know, hold space for that. It's difficult. It's hard. There are folks who do this work, like me, who hold space for that and helps people progress through that. And then just like other identities, race, ethnicity, gender, so on and so forth, so many different identity groups that you hold space and learn about from an interfaith understanding and dialogue perspective, being very clear that you're not here, or like the organization is not trying to like get into religious debates, and not about like proselytizing to anyone. It's literally just understanding an identity of another person so that you can appreciate the beauty of diversity of human experience. And this is one aspect of those things. Awesome. And I think that's also, oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about as you were speaking was that, you know, obviously there's like some systemic things that really need to be done within organizations around, you know, just like policies and guidance and handbooks but there's also on the individual side of things, I feel, you know, to your point, I think the conversation needs to be about focused on individual distinction and difference and perspective around religion and not necessarily about solving the issues that religion has created, right? Like the global issues, because I think like that's like when you, and I think people want to get into that. You know, we talked a little bit as we were kind of prepping for this, just about the fact that, well, one, you can't speak or be responsible for things that, you know, someone of the Muslim faith is doing in a different part of the world. But what you can speak to is your interpretation of the faith and your personal perspective and what matters to you, what's important to you. And maybe even some of the areas of commonality that you might have with Christians. Because we, you know, we also talked a little bit about the overlap between you know, Christianity and Islam, that Christianity is often spoken of as a cousin religion. And so I just, I think like if for individual leaders, because I think that's like one of the things that really catalyzes inclusion is when individual leaders have a little bit of a game plan, you know, when they get into a situation where religion comes up because there was this major Supreme Court decision that just got handed down a month ago. Yeah. And you're like, you're going to work and you're like, no, this is, you know, like, oh God, it's coming, you know, it's going to come.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What is, you know, I think the thing for leaders to consider doing is really to focus like on the individual perspective and not be making others right or wrong. And I think that's like one of the things we get into often with identity is that it, you've got, somebody's got to win, somebody's got to be right. And that's ultimately, that's like not what the workplace is about. It's about getting things done together.
Productive together. Absolutely. And workplaces are not, they're not responsible for solving the world's problems per se. Like that's a whole other topic that's sticky and complicated. So I will like just put in there that like there is nuance even in that.
Of course. Yeah.
However, having said that, for sure. Like you're not holding, honestly, leaders can get really, really far with just saying the quiet part out loud. Like, hey, there are a lot of emotions going on here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of heaviness. And again, this applies to so many different identity groups and the troubles and trials that go on in the news. Just recognizing, like verbally telling your folks, I know, we know there's a lot of emotion going on right now. I know there could be a lot of stress. Here are the resources and hopefully like time off or, you know, mental health assistance or whatever the case may be, stipends that the organization may have. If you don't have anything like that, then maybe like look into that, especially like given how burnout is so widespread, given, you know, the news and everything like going on in the world, climate change and so on. Like it's really stressful for your people and they can't continue to do good work for your organization even and when they want to, because just the world is such a dumpster fire.
Right.
So the idea being like holding space, saying the quiet part out loud and just saying like, hey, we know this can bring up a lot, not saying like this it is
definitively,
right. Yeah. Like just holding space for like, there are some people who are feeling this more and feeling this less. It may be a member of the impacted group. It might be someone who is triggered because of a similar triggering event in their community. And this reminds them of that. There's so many different, like very nuanced ideas to the idea of trauma and, you know, what can trigger people. There's a lot of emotion. Feel free to take, you know, Friday off or cancel your meetings or move non-essential meetings, or, you know, we're going to give, you know, everyone the day off on this day or whatever, whatever the case may be, whatever is within the organization's ability to take time to let your people feel things. And that's something that I've learned from, you know, therapy and, you know, trauma healing is the idea that if you allow yourself to feel the emotion instead of shutting down and trying to avoid it, it's a much less long-term effect because you let yourself really fully feel the sadness, the trauma, the, you know, anger at whatever is happening. And then you move out of it much more quickly compared to like avoiding, but it's there right. The whole time.
You've got to
have to give yourself the time to process it, right? So the idea being as a leader in an organization, you give your people and you encourage them and you lead by example as well. They can see that you're doing it, right? So it's making it okay and acceptable. And this is a part of our company culture. to process things. And then people will be able, hopefully, to move out of that emotional state and back into, like, ideally health, a healthy state, not like be productive and work. Like, yes, be productive and work, but hopefully, like, you care about the human beings in your organization as the human beings who deserve justice and dignity that they all do.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate your perspective on that. One of the things we've again touched on this a little bit, I'd love to like focus on the idea that, you know, the Muslim community is not a monolith, right? There are, like you said, 1.8 billion Muslims in the world. And this would probably be a 3-hour podcast, but I'd love to just like lightly touch on this idea. Cause I felt when we talked about it, I thought you did such a beautiful job of addressing some of like the big ideas in there. I'd love to hear a little bit from you about that.
Yeah, honestly, I could make literally a whole career, which I just might, of like literally just being like, Muslims are not a monolith. Muslims are not a monolith. Muslims are not a monolith. Muslims, like literally that's it. Just that one phrase, like Muslims are not a monolith. 5 words over and 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 over again. Right. And again, the idea being what I love about talking about Islam and Muslims is that a lot, if not everything, honestly, of what I'm saying can just be you could just pull out the word Muslim and put in a different identity group and say like, oh, Black folks are not a monolith. White folks are not a monolith. Jews are not a monolith. I don't know. Like, women are not a monolith. Like, everyone, no, like, no one is like a giant gray blob of everyone is exactly the same.
Right.
If you look at the example, for instance, I love this example. Like, if you are someone with siblings, say you are one of three siblings, you, two siblings, great. Are you going to be exactly the same as your siblings? You have the same parent, biological parents. You grew up in the same environment, the same home. And yet how many people, either you with your siblings or people that you know who have siblings, if you're an only child, are all the siblings exactly the same people? Of course not. Like, so why would you think that 1.8 billion people from all different countries, all different languages, different socioeconomic statuses, different secular educational levels, religious educational levels, different sects of Islam that believe various different things, though of course there's more overlap than not, but there are distinctions that are important to recognize. There's different like religious adherence, right? So even if they believe a certain thing, they may not choose to do so. Like, so many different ideas of diversity and of their identities that play into how they practice on their day-to-day life. So the idea being that if you are interacting with someone which either has told you that they're Muslim, or you can like see from them wearing a headscarf that they are Muslim, though I will say I am personally, this is an area of learning for me right now, is that I am learning about other groups that even in 2022 are wearing what would look to me as a Muslim woman wearing hijab to look like a hijab. And I would like greet them with an Islamic greeting that I do all Muslims when I see them. That aren't Muslim, right? And they wear a similar headscarf for their own religious practices. One person I met recently is an Orthodox Christian, and the other person is pagan. And yeah, I know. I'm like,
I appreciate
amazing.
You saying that.
I know. Yeah. How amazing is that,
that's
right?
Awesome.
So, like, just the diversity of human experience is like such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So even then, again, I just want to like clarify up until this point, and you know, having the humility myself, like I have a business where I teach DEI and intercultural stuff. And even then, of course, I have more to learn. How on earth could
I
possibly know everything about every culture that there possibly is ever? No, that's never
going to happen. I so appreciate you sharing what you're learning. Because I think, you know, we talk a lot about one of the goals of being to make people that work in the D&I space, often like in a corporate D&I setting, our hope is that we see them go from like a subject matter expert, right? Like people are like, oh, you're going to have all the answers. You're a Black woman. So you will have all the answers about Black women in America in a corporate setting, and really having them go from like a subject matter expert to like a center of excellence. Like this idea that you know, and I think that one of the distinctions there is that we recognize that centers of excellence like aren't perfect and they have things to learn. And so I so appreciate you sharing what you've learned and helping others learn more too. So
I'm so glad. Yeah. The idea being also, this is something that I really want to just make a point for anyone listening, especially if you are in a leadership position, as your sphere of influence will be more impactful and like larger scale than folks who aren't in leadership, though those folks, if that is you listening, your sphere of influence, even if it is not quite as large of a scale, is very, very, very important and also very impactful. The idea being that moving from this perspective in DEI or similar social justice fields, the idea being that the goal is to be perfect and to know all the things and never make any mistakes, that is never going to happen. Right. There's no one who can achieve that. That is completely unrealistic. And actually, that is a part of white supremacy culture, like perfectionism. Perfectionism is absolutely a part of white supremacy culture. And having the compassion that we were raised in a white supremacy culture, so you're not a bad person. Therefore, like, you should like hate on yourself because of that. This is something that I absolutely had to work through and, still have to catch myself now every once in a while. Like, I'm a recovering perfectionist and a recovering people pleaser. So the idea being that I would love to just constantly know the right thing to do, the right thing to say, never make any mistakes, never have to receive critical feedback, never have to like have anyone tell me like, Rahime, you hurt someone's feelings. Like, no, I did it there. Like, no. Like, right. Like, I would love to never be wrong. However, that's just not possible. And again, like recognizing actually how toxic it is to have that perspective and moving towards, hey, I know these things, but I know that I'm not perfect and I know there will always be more to learn. And that is a beautiful, exciting thing to know that there is more to learn. Absolutely. Yeah. Like a lot of people are like, I've seen people who just say like, oh, I'm a lifelong student, a lifelong learner. That's amazing. I personally believe that most people under the right circumstances, if they have like food and safety and, you know, like the basic needs of their life met, most people want to learn the rest of their lives. They're very curious people. They want to read books. They want to listen to podcasts. They want to like to learn new things. And that's a beautiful part of human beings and our nature. And the idea being of leaning into that and saying like, you know, for me as a leader, for me as someone who isn't a leader in an organization, the idea being that I am going to remain open and actually seek, hopefully, ideally, you know, feedback from folks about how I'm doing well. But also like how I can be better and more inclusive, and seeing it as just like a completely natural part of the process, perhaps have something to improve upon, so that when someone does come to you and say, hey, you know what, you didn't do this as well, like, could we talk about a better way of doing it? You just see it as like, oh, of course. Right. Like, I know that that will always happen and I'm expecting it and I'm ready and receptive for it.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for sharing your perspective with us. I feel, you know, it's like, it's humbling to, these conversations always feel so generous, especially when you have someone who has such perspective and experience, an obvious affection for people and improving things. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Well, we're kind of wrapping up a little bit. And the last question I wanted to ask you was, where can our listeners find you?
Absolutely. So I can be found on my website at RahimeRamazani.com. As you can imagine, there's not that many people with that name. So I got the .com. But I am also an active content creator. I really love using social media, particularly. Social media is not for everyone. It has its pros. It has its cons. There are toxic things about it. I appreciate that. None of this is like all, again, the idea is not perfection. Right. So the idea, though, is that I really love using social media to reach groups that I never would have met in person, to provide educational content and build community. Honestly, I've learned so much from the folks who, you know, comment and share their own perspectives. And I very much learn from other people's posts. So I am most active on LinkedIn and on TikTok, like two completely different sides of the spectrum. Oh, wow. But they're really, really fun. Like, I
come find you on TikTok.
You should. I have so much fun. TikTok is a
I am not
TikTok
a TikTok
is
user.
So much fun.
I'm not a TikTok user, but I might have to come to TikTok just to find you.
I highly recommend it. Like, honestly, I have learned so much on TikTok. And honestly, the idea, anyway, this is a whole other thing. Like, TikTok, if you are listening, if someone from TikTok is listening, like, come pay me to promote you. Like, I know that there are people who are on TikTok because I like encourage them to get on TikTok. So just like saying that. Like, pay me for my labor, but I'm also technically, yes, on Instagram and on you.
Cool. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks to Rahime Ramazani for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to click that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.